I've been asked to discuss with you cancer pain management in small animal practice. And what I want to share with you is nothing that's revolutionary. There are a few new techniques that we'll discuss, some new options for pain management, some constructive ways to use multimodal or balanced analgesia for cancer patients, recognizing the variety of types of pains that they can experience. But I'd like to emphasize now, and as we go through our discussion this morning for the next hour, that the primary responsibility and the opportunity that we have as clinicians and veterinarians and technicians to intervene for our patients with cancer is really the opportunity and the obligation to be aware of the potential for pain, to be sensitive to that possibility, and then to be very perceptive in judging the potential pain that our patients have, and then be creative in addressing that very real need that they have. This image is taken from Colorado just a little bit later in last spring, early summer, sent to me by one of our former students, Dr. Heidi Patterson. So I'm not sure where she was for that image, but I hope you all can enjoy it after the meeting. Cancer is a painful disease, and it's often a painful disease. And some of these numbers are taken from human patients. It's said that a third of all human cancer patients report some pain, and 60 to 90% of those who have advanced cancer report some level of pain and discomfort. It's almost uniform in the cancer patient. And yet 70 to 90% of those can achieve good results, good analgesia with appropriate therapy. Human patients fear pain in cancer more than they fear the death. And fortunately, our patients don't have that anticipation. Our dogs and cats don't worry if they get the big C for a diagnosis. But certainly their owners worry on their behalf. There's an extension of those concerns by the owners to their pet's care. And we can address those concerns for the owner and take good care of our patients. The fundamentals that I believe are important for cancer pain management include an understanding of the specific disease and then the extent of that disease in each patient. To recognize the cause and importance of each of the causes of pain, each of the contributing factors that may play a role in that animal's discomfort and distress. Be open to diverse management options. Be open to multimodal analgesia. Be willing to change therapy if things aren't going well. And recognize that the situation is very dynamic. Things will change, and we can change with them to address that patient's needs. Stage the pain management approach. And that's a fundamental of the requirements that the World Health Organization suggests for cancer pain management. And then finally, titrate, adjust, and balance our veterinary care to maintain the most appropriate control of that patient. Specifically, acute cancer-related pain is associated with surgical oncology and radiation therapy. We certainly recognize that in an operative setting, but I also have had a patient very recently that had some radiation burns as a result of an adenoma that was being radiated. With regard to chronic pain, a very different problem, the pain of metastasis, treatment-related pain, that brings up the issue of palliative care if a patient's been in pain for a long period of time. There certainly is a distinction between long-lasting acute pain that is associated with pathology and chronic pain that may not be associated with pathology, but is instead the result of wind-up and central sensitization of that patient so that that animal misinterprets incoming signals. And that's an important distinction between acute and chronic pain. But we might consider chronic pain also to be long-lasting pain that is associated with tissue pathology. And there certainly is some pain associated with the terminal cancer patient as well. There are aspects of suffering that we need to address, and the psychology of cancer with regard to the owner's interaction with that animal and when they believe the time might have come to terminate that animal's life with euthanasia. With regard to cancer surgery, it's so important to treat preemptively, to treat before the knife hits the flesh, if possible, and certainly that's possible in surgical oncology. There's a tremendous value of using local anesthetics in tumor removal, and we will talk extensively tomorrow about regional and local anesthetic techniques. One of the sessions that we have scheduled for tomorrow is on local and regional techniques. We'll touch upon them briefly here. In this case, we're about to remove a little tumor from this animal's rostral mandible, and we're doing a mandibular alveolar block or mental foramen block to desensitize the lower lip and gum in this patient. And again, we'll discuss the specific techniques in our session tomorrow. For an amputation in a patient, if this is a forelimb amputation, the use of local anesthetics can help prevent the development of syndromes like phantom limb pain. By blocking the assault on the spinal cord and brain associated with transection of major nerves, will tend to prevent the development of central sensitization. The surgeon in this case has a syringe with some lidocaine and probably some bupivacaine added to it, probably a half and half mixture. And each structure that looks like a nerve, they'll insert the needle in there, aspirate to make sure it's not a vessel. If it is indeed a nerve, inject that nerve with some local anesthetic prior to transection. Give it a few seconds to continue the dissection in the other tissues, and then transect that nerve. By having blocked that large nerve, again, we'll block the assault on the spinal cord that would set up that patient otherwise to misinterpretation of incoming signals and the potential for phantom limb pain. You know, most patients that we have that have an amputation do quite well. Dogs and cats do quite well, of course, on three legs, and we wish sometimes that we had one around for people to see if they're anticipating or contemplating an amputation for their own animal, because most animals do so well with three legs. But, you know, some of them don't. And it's not just those animals that are obese or have osteoarthritis in other limbs. Some of them just don't do well. And it may be that those patients after an amputation are the unfortunate few that develop syndromes like phantom limb pain or some other chronic pain associated with that amputation. They can't tell us, for instance, that that foot hurts that's no longer attached to them, as human patients can. But it's been shown in human patients that the use of local anesthetics, either as a neuroaxial block for epidural or spinal anesthesia, or by blocking specific nerves like this, can do so much good to prevent those chronic pain syndromes. Demonstration here of a brachial plexus block. Again, we'll address this technique tomorrow, can be useful in surgical procedures distal to the elbow. Toe amputation, for instance. The block is done about the level of the shoulder, but it really takes its major effect from the level of the elbow and distal. Each patient with cancer, of course, is comprehensively evaluated. Its history is important. We need to examine that animal in every site where there's some pain and dysfunction. We may need some analgesics to evaluate an area with some pathology in order to examine that area and examine tumors or dysfunction. And appropriate diagnostic tools, including radiographic techniques and other imaging modalities, will help us appreciate the extent of cancer pathology. But again, we're not really treating the pathology, we're treating the pain. And those two are quite distinct from one another. We need to evaluate the extent of the disease and the extent of the pain on an ongoing basis. Treat the pain early and aggressively to gain control. Some animals, when we start them on an analgesic treatment protocol to relieve their cancer pain, they may seem quite sedated. They may seem overly sedated. And we may feel that we have a need to back off on our medication. Sometimes that's useful. If we're treating them with some strong opioid analgesics, for instance, and they're too sleepy, it may be that we have too much sedation going along with that patient. But it might also be that that animal needs a rest. Okay? It may be that they need to sleep for a while. While we're waiting for them to sleep, to rest, there's also a process of tolerance, opioid tolerance, that develops. So we may need to reduce the dose. We may need to give that animal a couple of days to rest and adapt to that level of opioid. During that process, that amount of time, they may develop some tolerance so that they'll be more alert and still comfortable. So it's a very dynamic process of working with that patient, working with those owners, and working with our veterinary staff to titrate and adjust our treatment modality. We'll watch for the development of tolerance, both with regard to acceptance of the drug without undue sedation, but also tolerance may interfere with the analgesic efficacy. The development of tolerance may limit the analgesic efficacy of an opioid, and dose escalation may become necessary. And that's fine. Most of these opioids are very, very inexpensive. You can just go up on the dose if tolerance develops. There have been many reports in the literature of human patients with remarkable tolerance to opioids. There's one woman who was reported in the literature about 5 years ago who was taking 30 grams of morphine every day for her cancer pain and was still quite functional. There are side effects that are significant with that. Constipation is one. Those can be managed with medications and other modalities. But tolerance can increase the need of that patient for analgesics. Problems can occur and problems can be managed without resorting to increased pain for the patient. Acute cancer pain is also associated with tumor involvement and tumor progression. As it compresses nerves, for instance, as it erodes other tissues. There's also a paraneoplastic syndrome that can be particularly nasty with regard to how the animal feels, so we'll talk about that. Surgery and other procedures where we intervene with the patient may be associated with increased levels of pain, so we'll address that as we need to intervene for that patient with surgery. And again, I've emphasized that operative pain management is so very important for the cancer patient. It is often the first opportunity that we have to relieve their pain. And preemptive analgesics, that's analgesics administered as preoperative drugs before the surgery. It's a very, very important principle in surgical oncology. Chronic cancer pain, on the other hand, is more difficult to diagnose, more difficult to treat. It is obviously of a longer duration, less well-defined onset, associated with increased tumor progression, and yet it may subside during periods of tumor regression to the extent it's related to pathology. Certainly, chronic pain is associated with a negative quality of life. Owners may say that the patient's just not acting like herself. She's just not doing well. And in fact, that may lead to the presentation of the animal and ultimately the diagnosis. But that negative quality of life is often characterized by some behavioral changes, anxiety, depression, anorexia, sleep disturbances, maybe some inappropriate aggression. Perhaps the animal is fussy. Perhaps it's striking out at children or someone else who's trying to interact with the animal. It certainly interferes with a human-animal bond. We have different types of pain in cancer: somatic, visceral, neuropathic, inflammatory. Different ways of describing the process that leads to that cancer pain. Different underlying mechanisms that are important, with distinctions between them. With regard to somatic pain, it's often more acute, more specific in terms of localizing the pain. It's resulting from nociceptor activation that is specific. It can be described in human patients as a sharp, aching, throbbing, or pressure-like sensation. They can usually define the area of the pain quite well. It can be associated with metastatic bone pain, certainly operative pain, more characteristic of musculoskeletal instead of visceral pain. Visceral, on the other hand, is less well localized. The nociceptors of the thoracic abdominal pelvic cavity often yield referred pain, whether it's due to cancer or some other process. So it's more typical for visceral pain to be described as diffuse, gnawing, cramping, aching, a throbbing pain, pressure sensations. And these are descriptors that humans provide for us for visceral pain. In tomorrow's session on improvements in pain management, we'll discuss how we scale pain from time to time, how we evaluate a patient's level of discomfort, and how the owners can help us do that. It's very difficult for us to describe pain in ourselves, much more difficult for us to describe it in our patients, and then to scale it, say, how are we doing today compared to last week? And what do we aim to achieve? And then after our intervention, then how are we doing? Neuropathic cancer pain is particularly nasty. Neuropathic pain can be a result of central or peripheral nerve involvement, results from infiltration or compression of nerves, the level of the nerve root or plexus or lumbosacral nerve sheath. Nerves are damaged by tumor progression, certainly, by surgery, by radiation therapy. And then we have the syndromes like the phantom limb pain that we already discussed. These are often treated with anti-inflammatory doses of corticosteroids, decompression techniques, sometimes neurolytic techniques. Here we have a soup of mediators, a soup of inflammatory components. These are allogenic mediators, including histamine, serotonin, bradykinins, leukotrienes, prostaglandins. There are many others. These are the forces of darkness. These are the mediators of death, disease, and debilitation in our cancer patients. These are the things that make them feel lousy. These are the things that make us feel lousy if we have the flu. So we'd like to address these in terms of dampening down the paraneoplastic syndrome, in terms of making the patient feel better. And there's some things we can do to help, to help reduce these inflammatory mediators. Nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs can be valuable in this regard, and so can corticosteroids, to decrease that inflammatory process. It decreases the likelihood for substance P to be hammering these nerve endings. With regard to the paraneoplastic syndrome, these two plot hounds are related. This one is my dog, this is Loretta, and this is Susie, her cousin, and they are both 11 years old. And I think you can guess which one has the renal adenocarcinoma. For Loretta, we provided symptomatic and supportive therapy for her and gave her about 3 months, I think, of good level of comfort before it was time for her euthanasia. She had a bilateral renal adenocarcinoma. In her, we used Tylenol with codeine. And I chose to use that so that I could more freely use a corticosteroid. I chose the Tylenol and codeine instead of a traditional nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drug because I did not want to stack up corticosteroids and the traditional nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory medications. So we used acetaminophen and codeine and then occasionally gave her some corticosteroid to boost her and make her feel a little bit better when she was down from those paraneoplastic syndromes. Primary therapy in cancer involves the removal or reduction of the tumor mass by radiation, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, surgery, combination of those modalities. And then we need to treat the potential paraneoplastic syndromes, treat infections, treat other problems, maintain good organ function. And we focus on the prognosis for that animal also when we're discussing that patient's life and that patient's therapy with the owners. Discuss the quality of life and their focal issues in determining the willingness of the owner to treat that patient and what modalities are available to us. We have to decide whether to be curative or palliative in our approach and in our attempt, difference between reduction of that tumor mass and removal of the tumor, one representing definitive therapy and the other representing more of a supportive care role that may be characterized by amputation for curative versus limb-sparing surgery, perhaps in a palliative approach, as we'll see in a case example later. Emphasize again the perioperative analgesic therapy and combined or multimodal or balanced analgesic approaches. The World Health Organization developed a number of years ago a treatment strategy for cancer pain. This is based on a recognition of the intensity and severity of pain rather than the mechanism or etiology of that pain. It's designed to individualize and titrate the delivery of analgesic care to the patients, and central to the theme of the World Health Organization's analgesic ladder is an escalation of analgesic strategies as the level of pain increases. And there are three or sometimes four levels of intervention: mild, moderate, severe, and then refractory pain to be recognized. Here's one representation of the WHO analgesia ladder. And typically the recommendation is to start using non-opioid methods, for instance, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, when pain is perceived to be mild. When it becomes more severe, more persistent in the face of that analgesic approach, then add in a weak opioid, maintaining the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, shifting therapy somewhat, if you will, to escalate therapy in response to escalating pain. If pain continues to increase as the disease progresses, the recommendation is to move on to stronger analgesics, for instance, stronger opioids, and often, again, in combination with the underlying therapy with, for instance, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, maintain a balanced approach, a combination therapy, but escalating the pain management as the disease progresses and as the pain becomes more substantial with disease progression. Step one, to look at it in some more detail. With regard to the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, we have a variety of them listed here. Certainly we have a wide variety of choices now with regard to NSAIDs and veterinary medicine. It seems to have more and more available to us all the time. And once again, we have the option of using the acetaminophen in dogs, of course, only, in addition to the more typical non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Many, many options. Patients differ, of course, as you know, in their ability to tolerate different NSAIDs. I think we all have our favorites, and hopefully we have two or three favorites to choose from, because different patients have their own favorites, if you will. There are some animals, just as there are some human patients, that will tolerate one NSAID and yet not another. Some people can tolerate ibuprofen, for instance, but they can't tolerate naproxen or Aleve, and it may be just the reverse for other individuals. And that changes with time also. Some people can tolerate an NSAID for a long period of time and then starts to upset their stomach or it no longer relieves their pain. When physicians are prescribing NSAIDs for chronic use in human patients for a variety of purposes, they'll often switch. If a patient's been on an NSAID consistently in high levels for several months, they'll often take the patient off that NSAID and put them on another one. Sometimes with an intervening holiday, they'll call it, a pharmacologic holiday, to allow the body to recover from that NSAID so they're not stacking them up on top of each other. And that can be a challenging time for the patient to have that NSAID withdrawn, as it is in human patients. But some pharmacologists recommend that as being an important step to avoid the toxicity that can come from mixing non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And we can talk about that perhaps in tomorrow's session on pain management. Adjuvants can be added as they're needed, sometimes GI protectants. Misoprostol, H2 blockers, hydrogen ion blockers, variety of things to help protect the GI tract, variety of other medications can be used as necessary to allow patients to tolerate the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs as well. Step two, escalating on the WHO pain ladder, more moderate pain, we'll add to the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs some mild opiates, and again, there are many options available. One of the favorites that we use is the acetaminophen and codeine, Tylenol 3 or Tylenol 4. Tylenol 3 has 30 milligrams of codeine. Tylenol 4 has 60 milligrams of codeine. There's also an aspirin plus codeine preparation available in a variety of others. With regard to other opiates, buprenorphine is a valuable one. Partial agonist usually is the classification used for buprenorphine. Very useful in cats, even more so in dogs. And again, as we'll discuss tomorrow and in the session later this afternoon, buprenorphine has a wonderful feature of cats of having good bioavailability following oral administration. I wish that were true also in dogs, but it's not. Butorphanol has some value, very limited, particularly in dogs. Tramadol is something that we're using increasingly in our patients, both post-operative and in cancer pain management. And again, variety of adjuvants that may be added, antiemetics, antihistamines, corticosteroids, stool softeners if necessary, sometimes mood elevators, tranquilizers. Elevil is one that's very important in human cancer pain management and works quite well in our veterinary patients as well. And not just to sedate them, but actually helps relieve some anxiety and helps with analgesia as well. Many others as needed, and we'll always individualize therapy. And about this time is when we might have to get rather creative as pain becomes more and more of a problem for our patients. If we escalate up to step three, severe pain, we're adding stronger opioids, again, probably added to the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug or the foundation that we've already laid with regard to pain management. At this level, morphine is often a good choice. It should be noted that morphine has very questionable and often poor bioavailability following oral administration in dogs. That's been well documented in the pharmacologic literature. But some dogs achieve good analgesia with oral morphine, but some do not. Okay. Cats do not receive such as good analgesia with the morphine. They lack the enzyme that results in one of the byproducts, the breakdown products of morphine, 3-glucuronide, that's very important in analgesia. They don't tend to form that metabolite, and as a result, they don't achieve as good analgesia as do the dogs. But once again, the oral buprenorphine is a very valuable option in the cats. Some veterinarians will use the transdermal fentanyl preparation, the duragesic patches, for severe cancer pain. And there are some precautions that need to be recognized with regard to the transdermal patches, both with regard to patient safety and with regard to the potential for diversion and misuse of those patches. So we need to know our clients very well, need to know our patient pretty well also. There are some limitations, but certainly Duragesic patches have been valuable in managing cancer pain in animals. The Duragesic patches were only approved for use in cancer pain management in human patients, and certainly not approved for any perioperative use, and certainly not approved for use in any veterinary patient. And I feel quite confident that the manufacturer is not going to approach FDA for approval for use in animals, and they do not support the use of these patches in animals. But there is a tremendous literature available now in veterinary medicine with regard to pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics and clinical application for the fentanyl patches. And I'm sure most of you folks have used them in some capacity. Again, variety of adjuvants as needed. With regard to these patches, this dog has several stacked up on the back of his neck here. The patches, as you know, are available in a variety of different sizes. It's the surface area that controls the release, provides a basal level of strong opioid analgesia as an alternative to some of the oral preparations. Step four is the refractory pain. Yes, sir. Hydromorphone would be a fine choice for this level three, for the severe pain. Another pure agonist opioid. Okay. Hydromorphone working well in cats as well as in dogs. Can be associated occasionally with hyperthermia in cats. Probably a better choice in the cats than in the dogs. Other questions and thoughts? I should have invited you earlier to go ahead. Yes, right here. Yes. Mm-hmm. Question is about lidocaine patches, and I have used them in a variety of patients, and I have personal knowledge of their use in human patients as well. Some people think they work pretty well. I've been less impressed. Right now, my father-in-law uses them for shingles pain, and that's a nice application for lidocaine patches. The absorption is somewhat limited to the area of the patch application. And yet, when we talk tomorrow about advances in pain management, we'll talk about continuous rate systemic infusions of lidocaine. And I think some of the patients that have a lidocaine patch applied may actually develop adequate plasma levels to achieve a systemic benefit from that lidocaine patch. Have you used them yourself in patients? Yes. Yeah, good. Good. Comment up here, yes. 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 The question is quite a nice one, quite an involved one. It regards the concept of preemptive analgesia and how that fits into a scheme like the World Health Organization's strategy for escalating pain control once pain has been... and the comment is, with regard to preemptive analgesia, why don't we just go ahead and get on board very quickly, more aggressively, to control pain? And I think that's necessary. Preemptive analgesia really, as a concept, applies better to acute intervention, things like surgical oncology, as preoperative analgesic administration. If we get on board very quickly with regard to cancer pain management and jump to more aggressive strategies early on, that's not inappropriate. It may not be as necessary. Some patients will do quite well on a more simple strategy to begin with. I think once we recognize the cancer pain in our patients, we may already be up that ladder. So I would not discourage you at all from going ahead and being a little bit more aggressive. It may be that you can start your medications earlier and at a lower dose, and then your escalation might just involve escalating the dose. So it's an interesting combination of concepts. And I think that's great. That's perfect. And yes, sir?
Are you using
The question is, are we using a lot of injectable fentanyl as opposed to the patches? And yes, indeed we are. And again, we'll talk about that in our session on pain management. We use a great deal of the infusions, constant rate infusions, including fentanyl along with some other medications in a perioperative setting in particular. So yes, we're using fentanyl more these days as injectable formulation than we are in the form of the Duragesic patches. Yes, back here. Question is, do I allow for a washout period if I'm going from what to Tylenol? Question is, do I allow for a washout period if I'm going from something like Remedil to Tylenol 3? I think that a washout period in that specific example is less important, maybe less necessary in going from Remedil to Tylenol 3 than it would be if we were going from Remedil to another traditional NSAID, for instance, Meloxicam or Deramax or Prevacox or one of the other traditional NSAIDs, where we have that risk of combined NSAID toxicity with regard to the aspirin-induced lipoxin. I think when we're going from one traditional NSAID to another, it's necessary, particularly in these patients that are on high levels for a chronic period of time. I think it's necessary to have a washout. If instead we're going from an NSAID to acetaminophen or Tylenol, which really should not be listed along with the NSAIDs, I think it's less significant, less important. One more, I think. Yes. Yeah, the question is, as we move to an opioid in our pain management strategy and our ladder, if you will, is there an oral opioid that I particularly recommend? And I think codeine is a wonderful one. Codeine is very effective. Codeine is inexpensive. It can easily be scripted out and is available in the two formulations along with the acetaminophen, for instance, in dogs. Really nice preparation and a good choice. Okay. Yes, sir. Would I compare it with tramadol? I often add it to tramadol. I think tramadol is perhaps, in my experience, thinking its use in a lot of patients, a little bit weaker in its analgesic efficacy in many patients compared to the Tylenol 3, for instance. But tramadol is a wonderful analgesic and not associated with as much sedation as are our more traditional opioids. The analgesic mechanism is somewhat dependent on opiate binding, but it's more related to interference with serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake. So there's some very weak mu agonist binding, but most of it's a non-opioid mechanism and a nice choice for us, a nice new drug in analgesia. Thanks for your questions and comments. Keeps me from falling asleep up here. Okay. Let's see, we're still talking about refractory pain, and one of the comments mentioned gabapentin, okay, and amantadine, other alternative analgesics that we're using increasingly. Okay. These are often reserved for later in cancer pain management, but quite often we're far into this process before we recognize it, before we are sensitive enough to appreciate that our patients need that intervention. There are non-pharmacologic interventions also. Transcutaneous nerve stimulation in a lot of human patients, and some people have used this in veterinary patients also. Acupuncture, certainly, neurolytic procedures, and we must always recognize that analgesia is incompletely achieved in advanced cancer, and at some point euthanasia may become necessary. So we'll talk some more about terminal cancer pain. The fundamentals: understand the disease and extent, recognize the causes and importance of each pain, consider diverse management options, stage the management of pain, titrate, adjust, and balance care in order to maintain good quality of life, because that's what it's all about. Unwanted drug effects can be managed. If we anticipate those, watch out for them. We'll tell the owners, let us know if the animal stops eating, showing some sign of GI upset, for instance, or constipation. Monitor for some toxicities. Occasionally do that lab work. And yet recognize, if this is terminal cancer pain, liver enzymes start to go up. That's of interest. But we may be able to tolerate or accept some liver pathology, some decrease in renal function, if we need to control a patient's pain. If we're anticipating a lifespan of 3 to 4 months, we may be able to tolerate some renal or hepatic toxicity. It's a very different scenario than if we're treating an animal with chronic degenerative joint disease. Sedation frequently occurs early, and we can wait for tolerance or we can reduce dose as we described. We can manage constipation as a side effect with stool softeners, bulk laxatives, increased water consumption. We can manage GI toxicity in a variety of ways. Okay. But palliative care often includes planning for death. Progression of the disease may lead to unmanageable pain or really unmanageable drug side effects. There are toxicities from our therapy, as I mentioned, and concurrent diseases that eventually come along. None of us is going to live forever. So euthanasia does become a part of cancer care, really of cancer pain management. Okay. There is a very important role for hospice care. The owners of this cat reached the time for euthanasia. This cat didn't care that it had this tumor. It was running around quite happy, really. His pain was relatively easily managed, but they could see that the progression of this disease was moving on toward this cat's brain. It came time for euthanasia. But you can see the little stay sutures around here where we bandaged, put a bandage over this animal's head. So that hospice care can really be the most appreciated part of our interaction with the owners. When the time comes, euthanasia does relieve the pain and suffering. We want to maintain the quality of life. We'll maintain their appetite, activity, involvement with the family, maintain the function of those animals. I want to tell you about Tesla, a really nice 8-year-old male Rottweiler. He became lame and had some swelling of his left foreleg, and the owner first noticed this in about the April time period. And on radiographs, this lesion was found in the distal forelimb, an osteoblastic osteolytic lesion on the ulna. Biopsy did confirm osteosarcoma, but otherwise Tesla was really in good health. Had a history of some rear leg lameness, and at that time had poorly tolerated Remodel or carprofen. Tesla was sent in for cancer management, and a limb-sparing procedure was performed to remove that tumor from the distal ulna. That was on May 9th. And in an operative setting, we gave morphine and a brachial plexus block to reduce the requirement for anesthetics and to help contribute to operative and post-operative analgesia. Tesla was sent home on antibiotics and Remodel, which he now tolerated quite well, and scheduled for recheck and chemotherapy. And the left forelimb became quite sound as the summer progressed. And yet the radiologist suspected that there was some evil at work in the rest of Tesla. But not a problem as far as the dog was concerned. He's really quite functional in his family. Pain management was rated quite good by the owners with just that NSAID at this period of time. At rechecks and chemotherapy sessions, it ultimately found another bony lesion, this time on the right forelimb and also on the rib cage. And a bone scan confirmed metastatic disease in this nice dog. Pain management was still quite good. Here we see the right foreleg with that lesion developing. And also there's a tumor on one of the ribs, and from over here I can't find it. I think it's right there. And on bone scan, those were confirmed. So we have the World Health Organization ladder for analgesic management. We at this point have disseminated osteosarcoma, and we're not planning any further chemotherapy for this dog. Yet we'll continue our analgesic strategy and adjust it as necessary. We did this with periodic consultations with a referring DVM. And 4 months after the surgical procedure, the lameness and lethargy now returned. The Remodel was no longer adequate, and then we added some morphine. We started at 60 milligrams of oral morphine twice a day, and there was quite a bit of sedation, so we reduced it to 30 milligrams twice a day. And the sedation that developed and the pain management, the analgesia that were achieved, did demonstrate for us that at least in this dog, we did have good bioavailability of morphine and a good biological effect. So at this time, with the morphine and the continued carprofen, we had excellent results in an active and happy dog. Maintained that morphine Remodel and had consistent pain relief, reported as very comfortable by the owners for an additional 3 months after the addition of the oral sustained release morphine. Finally, on January, mid-January, 9 months after the diagnosis, Tesla had acutely deteriorated. He was weak, lethargic, pale mucous membranes, and had increased swelling and edema in that distal right foreleg. And the owner did elect euthanasia at that point. So we terminated that human-animal bond by euthanasia, and that always calls for the ultimate in sensitivity and skill, and that is certainly in itself a topic for much further discussion. Okay, so I wanted to share with you our good results with Tesla. That was quite some time ago. We didn't do anything fancy, but it worked quite well in that patient. I'd recommend that if we apply the skills we already have available in a creative fashion, and it sounds like some of you are already doing this with regard to cancer pain and using some strategies that we didn't go into very deeply with regard to alternative approaches, we can do a great deal to relieve cancer pain in our patients. Cancer therapy with regard to the survival of animals is much better than it has been in the past, and indeed cancer pain management is also now much better than it has been in the past. Any other thoughts or comments that we can share? Yes, sir.
Could you compare codeine and hydrocodone?
Yes, could I compare codeine and hydrocodone? I think typically hydrocodone is a little bit more effective analgesic, a little stronger analgesic, hydrocodone instead of codeine. Tolerance can develop with either one. In general, I'll reach for the codeine first and then think about hydrocodone later.
So you actually think that hydrocodone is more effective?
In many patients, I think it's somewhat more effective than codeine.
Do you find differences? Will one patient tolerate?
Absolutely. Yes, the question is... Yeah, the question is, do we find differences among one patient to another with regard to these variety of drugs? Absolutely so. Yes. And, you know, in some cases I don't know why, because they may both be strong mu agonist drugs, but differences in perhaps bioavailability, perhaps differences in logistics for the owner with regard to frequency of treatment. The industry has done a very good job of standardizing drug preparations, and the pharmacologists and clinicians have been remarkably effective at standardizing suggested treatment regimes. What we've not been able to do over the many, many, many years of veterinary medical intervention is to standardize patients. So they all differ, and we need to respond to them and titrate and adjust and work with the owners. And that's so important in cancer pain management, much more so than in perioperative management. I think in perioperative management, we have a few days to a week and most 2 weeks in which to work with an animal. With regard to cancer pain management, it's much longer than that. Had a question back here and then yours. Yes, sir. Ah, boy, that's a tough question. If a patient develops tolerance to one opioid, does it make sense to switch to another one? And there's some studies that suggest it might. They might have some better analgesic efficacy on another one. But in general, the tolerance crosses over from one drug to another. So if tolerance develops, if we still need the opioid analgesia, I think the answer in that case is to escalate the dose, or if we haven't already done so, to combine modalities. Perhaps add in something like amantadine or gabapentin or another modality like the Elavil, for instance. Right. Her comment is that in a variety of presentations and talks, she's getting a mixed report on the transdermal fentanyl, the duragesic patches, and their application and efficacy and utility. And I think we went through a period of time when in veterinary medicine we were making a very broad of transdermal fentanyl patches, and I will indeed talk with them this afternoon about their use in cats. As an example, as they in declaw analgesia. I think we went through somewhat of a honeymoon period with regard to the duragesic patches. And yet you've all heard stories of animals getting to the patch and chewing on them and either perhaps eating them even and either dying from that or having really interesting periods of profound sedation, somewhat reversed with naloxone or naltrexone. There are always big concerns about potential diversion and abuse with fentanyl patches. They can be quite expensive. They cannot be cut, for instance. There are different strategies to fold a patch over to limit its contact with different sizes of animals. it's a complex application. It's not supported by the specific industry that the Janssen Pharmaceutical that produces the patches. We still do use them sometimes, but as this person over here commented, asked if we were using more injectable fentanyl, and we are indeed. I've sort of come to the point where I use less transdermal fentanyl now than I did in the past. And a lot of that's personal preference. And you'll hear personal preference reflected not only with regard to transdermal fentanyl, but with regard to a variety of the different treatment modalities and special interests, whether it's pain management or some other talk that we hear in a variety of presentations. So our own personal preference does color our medical care. We try to base our therapy on good science. Evidence-based medicine would suggest that transdermal fentanyl can be well absorbed in a variety of animal species. We have a lot of really good data that's been accumulated with regard to the uptake and duration of action, the half-life, if you will, of fentanyl delivered from the diuregesic patch in a wide variety of animal species. We have a lot of data also that have been published, very good credible data, not only on the pharmacokinetics but also pharmacodynamics of how long it lasts. And we're starting to synthesize those two together, pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics, to really understand how these drugs work. So there's a lot of good science to provide an evidence-based rationale for using transdermal patches. And yet a lot of what we choose to use is based on our personal preference. My personal preference leads me to other options, actually, because of some of the other concerns. And yet I think it's a fine modality if we recognize the limitations and the risk factors. Yes?
What has been your experience using, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right,
Pamidronate
for osteosarcoma?
I believe Pamidronate is a drug that interferes with osteoblastic and osteolytic and osteoclastic activity, and I believe can be very effective in osteosarcoma, for instance. In our pharmacy, it's pretty expensive. Anybody else used it? Yeah. Yeah. Does seem to help, yeah. I think it can stabilize the bony tumors quite nicely. Anyone else used it? I'm drawing a blank on the class of drugs. Yeah, yes, the same class of drugs are used for osteoporosis. Can really help some of these patients and has been used in part of palliative care, not just for its analgesic efficacy, but to stabilize the bones. Yes?
A
couple of questions there. One, do we use splints to stabilize a limb, for instance, if an animal has an osteolytic lesion? And then the other is, if we control their pain, are they at increased risk of injuring themselves? I don't tend to use the splints. I don't think that's very effective, except maybe when they're first being evaluated and referred. That's going to be very temporary, if of any benefit. Certainly, if an animal develops pathologic fractures and the owner's contemplating euthanasia, it's time to stabilize them, give them good analgesics, and maybe splint them over the short term while they reach that decision. And then the related question, if we relieve the pain, for instance, in that animal with an osteosarcoma, are they more likely to then go out running after the frisbee and fracture that leg? And as you suggest, our pain control can be very, very good, and yet that animal still knows there's something wrong with that leg. And you know that if you've been in the hospital post-operatively, perhaps, and even if you have very good analgesia, you're very comfortable there, you know more than just at an intellectual level that you shouldn't get up and run 100 yards. Okay? Even if we have very good pain control in our patients, whether it's post-surgically or with regard to cancer pain, they still know that there's something wrong. So I do not think that animals are more likely to injure themselves, and that is, as you well know, that's an old myth about the use of analgesics, and it's unfortunately was used in years past as an excuse to undertreat pain. So I think you can relieve her concerns there, in that we can have a good approach to control the pain without a concern that it's going to lead to further injury. I think our time is up for this morning session. I thank you again for helping. Thank all of you.